Hey from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hello, Darren Patterson.
Hello, sir. How are you this February Eve?
You were going to say what day it was, and then you were like, I can't say that.
You
don't record this on the day it's released.
That's right.
I got a cover.
It's February.
Yes, it's February, and it's Black History Month. So we're covering one of the most important movies in Black history, I think. And to do that, we have a very special guest with us, our super producer, Frank Ablawi.
Hi, welcome, Frank. Don't blame me for this one, even though it is entirely my fault. But please don't blame me for this one. I don't want to be the guy who is known as the guy who likes to watch blackface movies. But yeah, we're watching a blackface movie. That's what we're doing for Black History Month.
I mean, does this qualify as blackface? I
100%.
You think so?
Yes. Yes,
yeah?
He is.
Okay.
I mean, it's through tanning pills, as he says. But yeah, it's pretty blackfacey, I'd say.
Well, I mean, in the world of the movie, it's tanning pills. But yeah. I think because it was a movie, it was done through makeup effects.
What? They didn't use actual tanning pills?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know what to believe.
Yeah. So yes, we are doing 1982's Soul Man, starring C. Thomas Howell, Ray Dong Chong, James Earl Jones. What? James Earl Jones? Yes.
James Earl Jones. Much worse than that, John. It is 1986's. I mean, every year this is closer to now is more of a question about why they did this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I'm just going to say right off the top, aged beautifully, holds up great, not no notes.
Like a fine one.
Highly recommended. Everyone go see this movie. You know what? We'll talk about it, but I would say that it may be aged better than you would expect for a movie that is entirely predicated on let's have a white guy put on makeup to be a black guy and see what happens.
I will say that this movie isn't as cringy as I thought. It has cringe moments for sure. Don't mistake that. But it's not as oh my god, what am I watching? As I thought it would be, which is the highest praise I can give it.
Yeah, it has moments. It tries to be thoughtful and it tries to deal with some of the issues that are raised by the premise.
Whether it succeeds or not, I think, is what we're going to be talking about for the next episode.
Yeah. I mean, it's... I will say, like, when the opening credits started rolling on this, I was like, wow, this movie has a great cast. This is, a pretty killer cast.
It's insane. It is... Yeah. So we've got C. Thomas Howell, which is obviously... He's the lead. Ari Gross.
Right.
Melora Hardin, who I would not have, like... Honestly, I would not have placed her name in the cast until she showed up. And I'm like, oh, it's Jan.
Jan from The Office.
Leslie Nielsen's in it. James Earl Jones is in it.
Leslie Nielsen, which I'd totally forgotten he was in this movie. And this is, like, he's only 2 years away from The Naked Gun.
Yeah.
And I looked him up on IMDb, and I was like, okay, is this, like, his last straight role before he became, like, rebranded as a comedy guy through The Naked Gun? And he was still doing like a lot of TV guest shots at this point. He was just like a working character actor. So Naked Gun, even though that was only 2 years away from in his future, he still had like a load of jobs between this and then.
For sure. So, let's get a little bit of backstory about this movie. Soul Man came out October 24th, 1986, directed by Steve Miner, who before this did Friday the 13th, Part 2 and 3.
So many things. He has directed so many films. He's a big director and still is. I think he's still working.
Wow.
Dead, right? Like, it's a lot of stuff. But, yeah. And also this.
Then this, yeah. And then after this movie, he did Forever Young with Mel Gibson, My Father the Hero, Halloween H2O. Of course, the winner. Right. And so this film was also written by Carol Black, who is not a black woman, just a white woman.
Okay, thank you for
Right. Yeah, yeah. Carol Black mainly writes for TV. Before this, she wrote a few episodes of Growing Pains. And this is the first and only movie she's ever written, because after this movie, she went on to co-create, produce, and write with her husband The Wonder Years, with her with her husband Neil Marlins. And then in the 90s, the two of them created and wrote and produced Ellen with Ellen DeGeneres, which is
the Ari Gross connection too. I recognize their names in the opening credits, and I remembered them from the Wonder Years, I think, because their names were on the show every week. And right. I was like, holy crap, the people who did The Wonder Years did this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's funny is there was a reboot of Wonder Years recently. It was pretty good. Did star a black family. And when I realized Carol Black was in it, I was like, is this the black Wonder Years? No.
Yeah.
No, not really. Pretty perplexing. I need to say this. Steve Miner also directed Warlock, one of my favorite weird, random horror movies. And we bring it, like, it's a movie that comes up way too often on non-pro shows because of how much I like it. A pretty good cast, pretty good production team and crew behind it.
Right. There is no shortage of talent behind this movie.
And the SNL namesake in this is Julia Louise Dreyfus. She is in this very briefly. Funny, I suppose, in her moment.
She does a decent job with what little she has to work with, but
it's a very problematic concept. But my argument for this thing is, like, I wanted us to hash out whether or not they did a good job with what they were aiming for, because there's a reason why we have so many high profile people involved in this project. And the time it came out, mid-80s.
It was the Cosby decade, as they know in the film. It was the Cosby decade. America loved black people.
I cannot believe that the blackface was not the most cringe thing that came up in this movie.
That was the funniest line of the whole movie. America loved black people.
Shocked.
It's the 80s. It's the Cosby decade. That was in the trailers.
Oh, my goodness.
That's how huge Bill Cosby was in 1986. And how beloved Bill Cosby was.
I want to justify things for the people who are already writing letters to whoever cancels podcasts. I guess time and common sense, whatever is responsible for canceling podcasts.
Yeah.
Why are we doing this? And why are we doing it during Black History Month? I'm blaming John Minus, comedian John Minus, who could be found, I don't know, probably on his LinkedIn profile. I think he's looking for work. John, and it wasn't, this is totally not even his fault. He's doing a show on our network called Geeks of Wrath. It streams on our Twitch channel on Tuesday nights. And one of his producers, or like his interns on the show or some made a reference to Pony Boy. And that led to C. Thomas Howell. And that made me remember C. Thomas Howell existed. And then Soul Man. And then I was like, I wonder if anyone in Soul Man was on SNL. And unfortunately, there was one person. So
and sure enough, yes, you were pleasantly slash unpleasantly surprised.
Yeah. So the least logical string of events led us to this.
And here we are.
Here we are.
When this movie came out, surprise, surprise, it was somewhat fraught with controversy. Some of the other people that were up for C. Thomas Howell's role were Anthony Michael Hall, Tim Robbins, Anthony Edwards, Val Kilmer, and John Cusack, all of whom declined this role.
Actually, I read that Tim Robbins was cast in the lead, but he had to pull out of the movie because shooting on Howard the Duck ran over.
Really?
You're just damned either way there.
Which is more embarrassing?
You're either the lead in Soul Man or you're a supporting character in Howard the Duck, one of the most notorious flops in Hollywood history.
That is probably the first time anyone has ever said, thank God for Howard the Duck.
Yeah, the only time anyone was ever grateful to be in Howard the Duck.
Yeah. And again, we're only talking so far, hypothetically, that the optics of this movie are incredibly bad.
Yeah, they are members. By the time the film came out, members of the NAACP spoke out against it. You know, they were not happy about it. I think the chapter president said, quote, "We certainly believe it is possible to use humor to reveal the ridiculousness of racism. However, the unhumorous and quite seriously made plot point of Soul Man is that no black student could be found in all of Los Angeles who is academically qualified for a scholarship geared to blacks." Mm-hmm. And one of the producers, Steve Tisch, he defended this film by comparing it to another film that we've done on this podcast, the film Tootsie, which, you know, features Dustin Hoffman as dressed as a woman who does so for like selfish reasons, but then comes to have a better understanding from another perspective through the women's eyes. So it's like, oh, so this is like Tootsie, which I don't know.
Is I think like they were going for that.
Yes.
I mean,
that is actually probably the best, like, if you wondered what was going on in the heads of these people, assuming they weren't bad people, they were aiming for Tootsie.
Yeah, and Tootsie, I think what makes that movie still work for the most part is, like, he is Dustin Hoffman's character, Michael Dorsey. He becomes a better man for experiencing life as a woman, and his eyes are opened a little bit. And there's a little of that in this, but it doesn't quite go far enough, I would say, you know?
Yeah.
There's a line towards the end of the movie that I think works.
Okay.
But I think overall the movie doesn't quite work. Something else was very interesting is a person who was very outspoken against this movie, Mr. Spike Lee.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. It says, he says, while not having seen the film in its entirety, Lee had seen clips of it, denouncing it as an attack on affirmative action. Additionally, Lee stated that C. Thomas Howell did not look legitimately African-American after his on-screen transformation.
Okay, I'll give him that.
Tough to argue with that.
Yeah.
The man has the most Caucasian features I've ever seen in my life. And Lee added, if the whole premise is that he's passing as black and it's so phony, that means that all the black people in the movie are idiots. Producer Steve Tisch reportedly made an angry phone call to Lee after he joked that Ray Dong Chong's card from the Sisterhood should be revoked.
Oh, damn. Damn, Ray.
That explains why I believe she has some feelings about Spike Lee.
I found also, like, there was a story, the Today Show covered this. They had a feature on this in 2021, and Ray Dong Chong spoke about that a bit. But we can get into that a little later, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I mean, with all this sort of angry, you know, negative press, the critics weren't kind to it either. I think Roger Ebert gave it 1 out of 4 stars, saying it's a genuinely interesting idea filled with dramatic possibilities, but the movie approaches it on the level of a dim-witted sitcom. So the critics weren't kind to it. It was getting all this controversy, but it still made money. It actually had a budget of like $4.5 million. It made,
you know why?
Why?
America loves black people.
Right on, right on, brother. But it actually opened at number 3 behind Crocodile Dundee and The Color of Money. And it like went on to make about $27 million or like $34 million. So it turned a profit.
So in 1986, America loved pool players, Australian people, and black people in that order.
Sounds right.
I'm beginning to think that America maybe doesn't love black people as much as it loves various kinds of white people.
What?
I don't know.
We like cocky pool players played by Tom Cruise. We like charming Australian guys with big knives. And then we like white people pretending to be black people.
Yeah. This is a very eye-opening moment for me.
I mean, honestly, that checks out. So, okay, should we get into the movie itself?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
We start out, we got these two buddies. We got Mark Watson, played by C. Thomas Howell, and Gordon Bloomfield, played by Ari Gross. And, you know, they're all excited because they're waiting for their acceptance letters from Harvard Law School. Gordon comes in to Mark's bedroom And, you know, we can tell that they're, like, cool guys because, like, Mark's in bed with a lady.
Yeah, he just just cooked up, bro.
That's right. That's right. You know, that's right. He, he gets laid. so he's a cool dude. And they're very nervous about opening their acceptance letters. And they open up their letters. They find out they both got in. From there, they're all ecstatic. And then Gordon says to Mark, finally acknowledging the woman in Mark's bed, who has not had a line of dialogue yet in this thing. He says, oh, I think an introduction is in order. And then Mark turns to the lady and he says, hi, my name's Mark Gordon.
He's so cool. So,
he went to bed with a lady whose name, they didn't even know each other's names. And that's why AIDS happened.
So, it's pretty rad, right, bros? Ow! Yeah.
So.
So it's a good introduction of Mark. We see he's like a rich kid. He's spoiled. He's pretty arrogant, and you know, just kind of goes through life with no cares in the world. And that's right.
He's got that white privilege, boy.
Oh, yeah. Does he ever?
We need to get into that by the end of this. After we do the recap, we got to talk about that word privilege because it's interesting how the movie doesn't mention it. Because it wasn't, well, at least it wasn't mainstream then.
Yeah, I don't think the movie, phrase white privilege was really.
But it does, in a way, get there. We will get there too. So here's the one thing I'll say. I don't mind recapping a movie, but a movie like this, which wastes no time getting all its ducks in a row, I timed it. We had 18 minutes before he was in blackface. 18 minutes from the start of the credits, all the characters blackface. That is not a long time. That is not at all a long time. They are efficient. They've wasted no time. You see, these are douchebag college kids. They want to go to Harvard to be douchebag lawyers. He has rich parents who will not pay for his college education.
Because they are also douchebags.
Because they are douchbag parents from L.A., I think, is it, or Beverly Hills?
They're in L.A., And I think the dad is from, he's the guy from Hill Street Blues, too.
And also played Doogie Howser's dad, James B. Seeking.
Yes.
Yes, and feel free to go, we could go back and talk
about one of the all-time great character actors. Again, this cast is stacked.
Yeah. And it is a hunt, like just a bunch of weird setups. Like the father is doing like a weird exercise on an inversion table while he's lecturing his son about being independent and getting his manhood. And all of this happens in 18 minutes. We get this guy's entire life story and how destitute he is. That is efficient. I'll give them that. It's also insane.
Well, you're the whole movie's like an hour 45 minutes. So
It's very weird. But that's the premise is can be done in a sentence.
Yeah.
Rich guy has a lot of money, can't access it because of his privilege and because he's never had to do anything for his life and has no credit and all that. And
the dad's giving him a speech and he's saying like, look, I want you to be like a self-sufficient man. That's why I've decided I'm not going to pay for law school. You're going to pay your own way. And we've used the money from your tuition account and we're using it to buy a timeshare in Barbados. So it's not that they haven't saved for him to go to law school. It's that they've decided we are not going to pay for law school after saving for it. So again, total dick move.
Yeah.
Fuck you, son.
They're building this kid and his entire structure, his like family support structure and his friends and everything as the most deplorable type of person you can imagine. And that I'm impressed.
And so Mark figures out, you know, what it will be to pay for tuition for 3 years of law school plus his living expenses. It comes out to a total of $53,979. I forgot to go into the inflation calculator. Let me see how much that is in today's money.
Yeah,
I remember it's a bunch.
I had to watch this with my wife, and one of the two remarks she made during this entire movie, as she sat grim-faced watching it with me, was, that's it? That's nothing. And then also something about, why are you paying for it all up front? damn.
Well, I think he's just yeah. like, I have to have that. Okay, so in 2026 dollars, that is $160,189.58. A cumulative rate of inflation of 196%, 196.8%.
Oh my.
This is the 40th anniversary of this movie. So if you're not taken to the streets by the end of this podcast, nothing's going to make you.
This podcast should just radicalize all of our listeners.
Yes.
Right. So we see Mark spiraling, like, how am I going to pay for college? Of course, he's looking for through fellowships. He doesn't qualify for any of them. He doesn't qualify for any financial aid because his parents make too much money. He tries to apply for a loan, but he has outstanding debts and he bounces checks. He basically does everything except get a job.
That's never really considered.
No, it never is.
It never comes up. Not till the last.
The word job is even uttered in the first 18 minutes of this movie. He's just like, where am I going to get this money? How can I get this money? What can I ever do?
Where can I get money?
How do people get money? Where does money come from?
It makes sense for the character because, he is soft and he has been pampered and he doesn't know how to fend for himself. But still, for blue collar Joes like us, the fact that it just never occurs to him to just get a job, any job, is fucking hilarious. And he goes and talks to his dad's therapist who put the idea in his head to cut him
off. Played by another great character actor, Max Wright.
The dad from Elf.
And also, Misfits of Science and, so many things.
Yeah.
And this is around where we get my one documented laugh in this entire movie.
Okay.
That was intentional, that the film actually wanted me to laugh at. There's a scene where he's looking for a loan, and there's a whole list of reasons why he can't get the loan, including bouncing checks from the very bank he's attempting to get a loan. But the thing that I was truly amused by is when he's sitting there and there's a dot matrix printer printing out, I guess, his credit history or lack thereof. And as it's making that noise, there's a look on C. Thomas Howell's face that matches the sound of a dot matrix printer going nuts and showing your horrible, your future. There's just this very awkward moment that I thought was very funny and well shot compared to the other parts in this film, which are just perplexing. Just perplexing. I'm going to pull out the dot matrix printer. I slowed the podcast down.
So Mark and Gordon, they're going through all these possible scholarships and fellowships. And he's like, hey, there's this one. This would be great. This is for the most qualified applicant, blah, 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 blah. And then Mark points out, most qualified black applicant.
Obviously
can't do that one.
Yeah.
And then cut to a committee saying, Mark, you're gonna be wonderful. Welcome to Harvard. And then he pops up into frame and we see C. Thomas Howell just, sort of brownish.
Yeah.
with a wig, it's not quite an Afro wig, I would say.
I think he just permed his hair.
They never say if it's a wig or not. I mean,
yeah, it's more of a Jerry curl, I'd say.
Yeah, Afro. Yeah, it seemed more Jerry curl.
Yeah, it's like Samuel Jackson in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
It's like that.
And he's just like, thank you, sir. And he, again, C. Thomas Howell, most Caucasian features you've ever seen in your life. He doesn't change his voice at all. Apparently he was wearing contacts because his eyes were kind of a goldish color that really stood out once he had his skin darkened.
He doesn't, his look looks so odd. Like, he doesn't, I guess he could pass for black. He looks more like Bruno Mars.
You think so?
No. As soon as I said it.
I'll say this. I wouldn't question it if I saw him in the street because I'm not a monster questioning people's race as I see them walking down the street.
Wow. Me neither.
I am.
Yeah. But
every person I meet on the street, I'm like, pure prove you're of this race.
Right now, John Trumbull's pulling out a big binder. He has, here's a picture of all the people I saw today and what I think their race is.
What are you? Like,
this person is definitely black. This person is definitely white. These people are kind of questionable.
I have charts. I have graphs. It's all here.
Yeah. So it's... Yeah, he has a very weird look in this film, which is partially intentional. I mean, you don't cast a known...
Like, the skin tone doesn't seem to be consistent throughout the film.
Yeah.
Some films he's like... or some scenes he's like a little darker skinned. Some scenes he's a little lighter skinned. I don't know if it's how it was shot. Some scenes he just looks sort of grayish.
Mm. Yeah,
it's really odd. And in the world of the movie, he says, I did a new... product of tanning pills. They have like this friend who we see in an early party scene, and he's like, I got these tanning pills from our friend Seth, and I exceeded the recommended dosage. And they don't get into it beyond that at all. It's like they never even say, like, does he have to keep taking these periodically to maintain the skin tone?
Yeah. Because
at the end of the movie, he comes back and he's white, and it's like, well, did you just stop taking the pill? Are you taking the pills every day? I wish they could have gotten into the mechanics of this a bit more.
Yeah, like the whole science of the tanning pills really doesn't come into play at all. At all in this movie, really.
Yeah, it's just this weird plot device.
Yeah, I appreciate it in that. God, there's so many things that would be taken out of context to prevent me from ever running for office.
Yeah, okay, you appreciate the blackface because. Yeah.
Because, like, I would rather them not spend any time. Like, I think the reason they did it, one is maybe to skirt around it being blackface, which is ridiculous because that's stupid. The actor was obviously wearing black makeup. I think it was primarily so they didn't have scenes where he's awkwardly trying to take the makeup off and putting it on and stuff, which I can't imagine these folks wanted to miss any comedy opportunity that came up, but maybe they just didn't want to. So it was like a shortcut.
But again, that's missing like some of the comedy opportunities of Tootsie, because we see scenes where he's like, where in Tootsie, where he's trying to switch between the male and female identities quickly. And we don't have any of that in this movie. We can't really have any of that in this movie because of the tanning pill thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a good call. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of have a scene like that towards the end with the ski mask, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, maybe they just wanted it to flow better.
So he shows Gordon, like, here's what I did. I got into Harvard, you know, through this scholarship or fellowship, whatever it is. And he says that there were only four people from L.A. who got into Harvard. Only one of these people was black, and that person got a better deal from Stanford.
Yeah. So I'm not hurting anybody. This is a victimless crime. So
like this money wouldn't have gone to anybody if I hadn't taken the scholarship. So I'm not depriving somebody else of the scholarship.
Yeah. And Gordon says, hey, this means you have to be like this for like 3 years. Have you thought about that? Can you do that? And he's like, yeah, it'll be fine. It'll be fun. It'll be great. I was like, ugh.
Again, I'm going to give... So here's another thing where I'm shocked that this movie actually... Maybe I shouldn't be shocked, because I think if these names committed to doing this movie, they at least on some level had to try, right? Because this was not just... this. I'm not saying this is bamboozled, right? This isn't Spike Lee 2000 bamboozled.
Right.
But certainly because the people involved in this are not black, right? They're not... The creative forces behind this are not black, so there's...
Nope.
There's limited things they can say about the experience, but they are at least trying to build first a kind of a despicable kind of like privileged jerk in the beginning, but give him an out where he's not being horrible because he's not taking it from someone. Right.
That's, he's not doing it maliciously.
Right. And it's like Darren said, a victimless crime. Obviously we find out that that's not quite the case, but the character we're following at the beginning isn't willing to take from someone. He is just, trying to do whatever he can to make his dream come true without hurting anybody, or so he thinks. So
he's got a whole law career to do that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we know what lawyers are like.
God. Wow. Mm. Shout out to our lawyer listeners out there.
No, they can't listen. They can only feel vibrations through their skin.
Oh, feel the vibrations.
No. So Mark and Gordon, they go off to Harvard, and we see them like registering at school, and he has to take the like his registration form, and he sees that like white is checked off under the ethnic information on his form, and he has to take that and like wipe that out with liquid paper. And mark that out and then, you know, mark in black. And they get an apartment. They get like a nice looking townhouse in the Boston area. And the super is Jeff Altman.
From Pink Lady and Jeff fame.
Yes. Yes. And Jeff Altman, he seems none too pleased at first because he's like, he kind of takes Ari Gross aside and he's like, you know, when your mom, you know, rented this place for you, she didn't say that your roommate was a black Negro. And I will say this is one scene I found a little amusing where Ari Gross was like, he's a black Negro. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you for letting me know. I never noticed before. Yeah. And I think Ari Gross plays that really well.
He is the king of the 80s best friend. He does a great job with actually this entire film. He does a very good job of being like the voice of reason a little, but kind of a scumbag. He does a great job in this film. And the black Negro scene where he just delivers it over and over again as a punchline is nice. It's nice to see him kind of like thumbing his nose at the obvious racist.
Yeah.
The obvious Boston racist, which I don't think they even have those there.
No.
I mean, Boston, very famously not racist.
Pretty liberal.
Yep.
Yeah. And you know, they get into their new apartment. They spot a pretty girl from the window. It's Melora Hardin. She's Whitney, and her dad is Leslie Nielsen. He's the owner of the property, and we see him like go up to Jeff Altman. He's like, well, you know, hey, I'm not happy about this because it's like the 80s and I'm like this Donald Trump-like landlord. And I, you know, I don't want to rent to anyone of the Negro persuasion. So keep an eye on them. If they do anything that violates a lease, anything, we'll throw them out immediately. And then they cut to Ari Gross saying, like, we should get an ocelot.
Yeah.
What was that? That was so weird.
That was I'm really
I enjoyed that worried just about it was saying such a this, random joke.
I enjoyed that joke as well because it was if they like I don't know if he said it, if they hammer anything in the walls, if they have loud music or pets,
right. Yes,
we'll get them. And after like the comedy threes of the three things you shouldn't do, it was a rapid fire montage of blasting the speaker, a hammer through the wall, and for no reason, Ari says we should get an ocelot, not even a normal.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now I get
that, it. So it's got that classic comedy setup. So I had to smile at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I just enjoyed the randomness of we should get an ocelot, which is the most weird, impractical animal you could get. So they go to a mixer, you know, for all the new students and stuff. And they're both players. So they're like, you know, scouting out the ladies,
the babes.
And Mark spots Ray Dong Chong playing Sarah Walker, another new law student at Harvard. There are also a couple of douchebag guys who are just like telling racist jokes, and they pop up throughout the movie just telling racist jokes to
each other.
These
characters, the fact that these, and they're telling really off-colored, like almost like you would get from a book. Why does a black guy not know how to cross the road?
The only one I remember, they were like, oh, it's, you know, what do you, there's like a 99 black guys and one white guy. What do you call the white guy? And the punch, quote unquote, punchline was warden.
Yeah.
And then they immediately notice that a, you know, what appears to be a black man is standing nearby. And they're like, oh, hey, sorry, no offense. And then they pop up, and the movie takes place like over the course of the first semester of law school. And these guys pop up, and that is all they do is just tell racist jokes to each other. And apparently they are just majoring in racism at Harvard Law.
that is it. They have no other. It would have been so easy to make them like classmates of his that occasionally tell a racist joke and that he's increasingly more uncomfortable about it. That's the through line, is that they're he is increasingly more uncomfortable with what they say. He starts off with like no problem.
Those 3 months or 4 months just telling racist jokes to each other. They have no other function in the movie.
They walk in oblivious to the people around them, telling a bunch of like from the book racist jokes to each other, taking it back and forth
at the mixer, in the library, in the cafeteria, I think in class or at the hearing at the end.
Imagine meeting up with your friend in the library because you've got 3 or 4 new bangers to talk. maybe these guys were stand-ups. Never mind, this is the stress.
They were testing out material.
Never mind. I'm sorry for questioning it. It's completely Boston comedy scene.
Right.
Yeah. So
trying them out on each other before they go to the mics.
Right. Yep. Right. That makes total sense. Okay. And Mark, when they're registering for classes, he decides he's going to take a criminal law class because he notices that the professor is James Earl Jones. He's like, I'm going to take this criminal law class because there's a brother teaching it.
Not a brother, a brother.
A brother.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that when he gets to class, because they're sitting in alphabetical order, he is sitting next to Sarah Walker. He's Mark Watson. So, you know.
Oh, I never put that together.
It's like a meet cute.
All right. Yeah.
Nice. And we see Sarah invites him to the BLSA, the Black Law Student Association. Of course, he doesn't know what that is at first. And then Gordon says, oh, yeah, it's like a, Black Law Student Association. I think they're like kind of militant. So then he just shows up dressed up like a Black Panther and like army fatigues and a beret.
It's a 70s Black Panther is what he dresses like up as.
Yeah, black turtleneck, beret.
Not the animal, the Black Panther, an actual.
Yeah. The
superhero.
They're literally playing the theme from Shaft as he's marching down the hall.
It's
a weird little gag. I was like, all right, I guess. That's something. Yeah.
And then he opens the door and everyone is staring at him like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. So if the joke there is it's more evidence of how out of touch he is.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, but that's so, and I think that's what, spoiler alert, why Roger Ebert might be right on the money for how he sees this film, is like, it's like, you almost got something, but you went way broad in a way that didn't even pay off funny-wise. It was just
No.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I mean, that's like all that is. And it's just a,
very much so. So then we cut this other scene where Gordon and Mark, want to go to the gym and play some basketball. And like, so they're splitting up into teams. And the two guys want Mark to be on their team because he's, he's Black and Black people. Mm-hmm. That one of the guys happens to be Ron Reagan Jr., of all people.
Son of U.S. President Ronald Reagan. Ron Reagan. And I read that apparently this film screened at the White House because of that. And,
oh, my God.
And, somebody in some of the documentation at the White House is like, President and Mrs. Reagan enjoyed the film and they enjoyed seeing their son. Your son plays a racist in this movie.
Yep.
Wow.
But Ronald Reagan gets a name drop later on in this film.
Yeah. They're picking
what's the precedent.
And Ron Reagan's character keeps calling Mark Marcus and Washington. And he's like, no, it's Mark and Watson. And he's like, oh, right. Sorry,
baby. But then Mark says, no. I know what you think. I'm really just okay at basketball. And of course, the other guys are like, sure you are, Marcus. Sure you are. And then we get this montage scene of to see how bad Mark is at basketball. He's terrible. And it's all done to the song Soul Man, which an updated cover they did with Sam Cooke and Lou Reed, of all people, on this thing.
Yeah.
The music choices in this film are all over the place.
You very simply hear Lou Reed's voice in it. And according to Wikipedia, it says the video starred actors Bruce Willis, Sybil Shepherd, Cassandra Peterson, Ray Dong Chong, C. Thomas Howell, Ron Reagan, George Segal, Jamie Farr, boxer Ray Mancini, and the children's character Gumby all singing to the song.
Wait, what?
The producer, Titch, he recruited the actors to do the cameos. I have not looked up this music video yet, but I am going to do that immediately after we finish.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, pause the podcast, folks. Look this up and come back. Because that, yeah. I almost want to do that. That's a, Cassandra Peterson is in it. That is...
Elvira is in it. I don't know if she's in it as herself or as Elvira.
Yeah, that's what I'm really excited to find out. Crazy. While we're doing crazy, before we move on from, I thought it was pretty fun to see him fail at basketball. It just was
he
amusing
actually at one
to
point
see.
Dribbles the ball in between his legs and hits himself in the crotch.
Yeah, I mean, once you get a crotch shot in a comedy movie, you've pretty much given up.
That's right.
Yeah. But there was a moment. There was a scene before this, right as he realizes he was wrong of the BLSA, the Militant Black Student Organization. He comes back to confront Ari, whose name isn't Ari.
Gordon.
I can't remember his
Gordon.
Name. Greg? Gordon.
Gordon.
And did you notice that he dips his banana in the coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking about an actual banana, folks. It's not a euphemism.
Yeah, we're not speaking any euphemisms here.
Yeah, he just
like Mark
dips
has
his banana.
A banana. Ari Gross grabs the banana, dips it in the coffee, and
Yeah.
And I feel like I know so much about what those two actors were like on the set of this movie and what they hoped they were doing from that one scene.
Uh-huh.
They were working their relationship, the absurdist comedy angles. They must have been so disappointed by the reception of this film.
Yeah. I think they thought like, oh, that's like a quirky thing my character does. Yeah. He's zany. People will love it. And
this is BJ Honeycutt and Hawkeye Pierce practicing their repertoire for hours before they go shoot MASH. And then they're like, all right, this is good. This is going to really work. This feels
this
like we know
stuff.
Each other.
Yeah, that was great stuff.
Yeah.
BJ Honeycutt. Oh, wow.
40 years later, I noticed it, guys. You did great.
Oh, God. Holy Toledo.
So, you know, we got Mark. He's still very interested in Sarah. He asks Sarah out. She doesn't really want to go on a date, but they make what she calls an appointment to study together on Friday night. Mm-hmm. So she's throwing him that bone. And we also see Mark and Gordon. They run into Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her boyfriend. The character's name is Brad Smalls. And because they know Mark as, you know, the white man that he is, he has to immediately pretend that he's not himself. So he slaps on some sunglasses and starts bobbing his head back and forth like Stevie Wonder.
It's a Stevie Wonder he pulls off.
Yeah.
Which you they know, don't like, even make him blind. They make him deaf.
Which yeah, he says he's deaf and mute because they didn't want her to recognize his voice.
Right.
So she's like yelling at him so she can be heard. And Gordon introduces him as Kareem Abdul Ali.
Ha!
Which.
That's a black name.
Those are two black names, my friend.
That's three. There's many black names.
It's two and two. We chuckle or eat it.
Kareem, the Canadian non-Muslim, as Julia refers to him.
Oof. Yeah. So.
Muslim.
Yeah. Oi, that's.
So we get a. "Quote unquote fun awkward scene there where he's trying not to give the game away.
Yeah, and it's just like the beginning. This is the second blackface in disguise. I don't know what to refer to this as scene. We've got the militant black stereotype and the, I guess, Stevie Wonder black stereotype now, and it's just going to get worse from here, folks.
Oh, there's more coming. There are more coming.
It gets worse. Like these two were bad, but it gets worse.
Yeah.
This is also where we set up the stakes of the film, where he has to continue hiding no matter what, because if he gets kicked out, there are people there looking to get him kicked out or get anybody kicked out.
And then after the scene, Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her boyfriend, they fuck off for the next 30 minutes and we don't see them again.
Yeah. Until there is literally, she's in, I think, 3, maybe 4 scenes of this movie. I feel so guilty for forcing this upon the podcast for them. But I didn't say anything about it because I was going to stop now.
Yeah, because like their storyline really doesn't amount to much at the end of this movie. Because like we're kind of led to believe like, oh, they're the ones that's going to out him and bust his case wide open. And that doesn't really happen. It kind of fizzles out.
It's a gag, which we'll, I guess, get to, which is sort of amusing, but not, I don't think, worth having all these extra characters in there.
It's sort of amusing.
Yeah. And maybe it raises the stakes momentarily for him being worried about coming clean because there's consequences to it, but there are much more and better consequences that are established in the film. So it's very odd.
Yeah. Then we have a scene where Whitney, Melora Hardin's character, who I guess she's living in the same brownstone in another apartment. They're kind of vague about that.
Yeah.
But she comes by the apartment. She says, like, hey, Mark, can you help me change the washer in my shower? The super isn't here. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll come over and be handy. And then they end up sleeping together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
because he loves civil rights too.
they both have a shared interest in civil rights.
Yeah.
And we see them sort of post-coital. They're in bed together and she's like, oh, that was interesting. You know, like how certain stereotypes were true and certain stereotypes weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And she literally says, I could feel 400 years of anger and oppression in every pelvic thrust.
Right.
That's how I do it.
So.
Oh, we all know.
I mean, you must hear that every time, right, Derek?
He's only talking about humping the stool during his set. Yeah. And yes. Still.
Yep.
Yes, you can still see it.
That's right.
Yeah, but and then he says, like, well, what stereotypes are true? And she's like, oh, well, penis size. And then we get a little double take where he's like, oh, my penis is bad.
Womp womp.
The white people in this movie come off so badly.
Yeah.
Which is good in the context of this film.
Right.
But somehow it, like, I get why people like Spike Lee would say, like, this is really an affront to Black people or affirmative action or whatever. It definitely was not the intent at this point, because you could see the type of, even the I don't know, pro Black people and the white people who are pro Black people in this film are like the most insufferable kind of white person.
Yes.
Yeah. And oh God. Yeah. So like I said, it gets worse.
I'm trying to think like who the positive examples of white people are in this movie.
Yeah.
I'm kind of coming up short. I guess Ari Gross is okay.
Yeah. Gordon wasn't terrible except for like, he didn't even get a chance to tell him not to do these things. He did everything before he talked to him about it.
Right. Right. Well, again, it's like Tootsie where it's just, we surprise the friend with, hey, look at this crazy thing I did. You're going to help me do it now. And they're just kind of roped into it like Sidney Pollack.
They 100% just try to do Black Tootsie.
Yeah, they really are.
I did not piece that together until this moment.
So Whitney invites Mark over to dinner with her parents, with her dad, played by Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
And it's so weird to see Leslie Nielsen in a part like this, just a couple years removed from Naked Gun.
Yeah.
So it's Leslie Nielsen, his wife, and like Whitney's little brother. And then each person at the dinner sees Mark as their own racist depiction of Black people, I guess.
Yep. Yeah. I don't even know if we need to go through this because I feel bad. Broadly, the mother sexualizes him.
Yeah.
Right. As a savage, but like a romance cover savage, but still.
Yeah, I was like, I don't even know how to phrase this in my notes.
Yeah.
Like a Nubian warrior of Coitus?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Didn't he have a knife?
Yeah, it is knife.
I can't remember.
I think he wanted white women. I'm going to ravage you. I've always wanted a white woman.
Yeah.
And then... Somebody please clip that soundbite
of John Trouble being very not like passionate about. Yeah, I've always wanted. I'm going to ravage you.
Clip that soundbite immediately, people. That's my new ringtone.
That's gonna go on all my dating profiles.
That's great.
And then the little brother sees him as Prince
because black people are cool.
Which again, I can't believe I'm saying this. A little bit of a hats off that they're acknowledging this is still like a painful depiction, right? It's still a stereotype. You can't just show a famous black person and be like, no, that's cool, right? You don't mind being a famous black person. It's okay. I could call you by the most famous person of your race, their name, and that's fun. Yeah, so that's...
And Leslie Nielsen sees him as, well, basically like a pimp-eating watermelon.
Oof. Yeah. Yeah.
So...
And actually uses the one and I think only actual N-word in this film, right?
No, there's the other one.
No, there's an N-bomb later on.
Oh, is there?
When he goes to jail.
Oh, that's right.
I forgot there was an N-bomb in this scene.
Actually, I think that's it. I think I didn't write any more details. Yeah. I don't think Leslie Nielsen... I think he was aware. He's like, I don't need to see that.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking in stereotypical pimp.
Yeah.
Speak.
Talking about heroin needles and whatnot.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. And for this, Mark misses his study date with Sarah.
Yeah.
Wah, wah.
So Sarah's all pissed and, Mark feels sorry. And then James Earl Jones, the professor, mentions that the first paper is due the week before Thanksgiving. So far, Sarah gets an A+ in her last paper. Mark gets a C+. He apologizes and asks if they can study it again tonight. She says no. And then that's when Mark sees Sarah working at the cafeteria. Like, she has a second job. She's working her way through college.
Wait a minute.
Okay, wait.
Slow that down.
She had to earn money for law school.
Yeah. Right?
So she got a, let me look at my notes, a...
Job. Yeah. Yeah.
A job. And apparently with these jobs... You do work, and they give you money for the work.
I'm just as surprised as you are.
That's huge if true.
Wow.
yes. Man, you really got to read the Bible closely.
I read the Cliff Note.
And in this cafeteria scene, we see the two racist jokesters again. Yeah.
Jeff, what are they doing?
I don't know. This is apparently how they spend all their time.
Oh my God!
They're the Rosencrantz.
I would be interested in a film of just those guys on their off time, just pencil in hand, legal pad. Because I got it. It's almost there.
And I don't think they're even exchanging jokes. I think it's just literally one guy telling the racist jokes to the other one. But the other one is like, yeah, all right, lay it on me.
Yeah, they're the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this movie.
Right. Yeah, we need to see this movie from their point of view.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so now it's time to get real. We get serious. We get to the part where Mark is driving on the road and he gets followed by a cop.
Uh-oh. Mm. Yeah.
Shit's about to get real.
Mm. Yeah.
He gets pulled over. Like he's driving. The cops, following him closely for quite some time. And you see Mark, and he's just like, "What the hell? What's going on?" And he's driving very carefully. But then, like, there's a woman, I think, on the curb who like unexpectedly opens a door. He swerves to avoid that, and then the cop immediately pulls him over and says, "You changed lanes without signaling."
Oh, come on.
Yeah. And he's like, "Oh, give me your license, or did you forget that too?"
Mm.
And then Mark starts to give him his license, and then he realizes, "Oh, I can't give this to him because the picture shows that I'm white."
Right.
And
which really doesn't track. I mean, you could be like, "This is me. It's obviously me. I'm on tanning pills," which is weird, I guess. But
do you think that would go over well?
I think it would probably go over better than I lost my wallet to a clearly racist cop. But I guess part of the thing is he's learning that it's hard to be black. to some extent.
He is, to his surprise, arrested when he cannot produce a driver's license.
What?
And he's like, what? You know, you're arresting me for this? So I guess it's supposed to show like how sheltered of a life he has. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think, and he even gets to the point, James Earl Jones will get us there at the end.
Yeah. So he's arrested. He's taken to jail. He's thrown into a cell with, I think, are they Green Bay Packer fans, I'm assuming?
I don't know. They just have.
I didn't recognize the uniforms.
No.
Oh, no. They would have been some Celtics, maybe? I don't. They got to be a Boston.
Or is it just some generic, and it's a generic uniform and it's not tied to any one sports team?
I think that they're leaning toward, like, you're supposed to realize they are a Boston area sports team fans, but I don't think they went for a full. These are the fans.
I can't imagine any team agreeing to like let their uniforms appear.
Oh, hey, yeah, we'll give you the jerseys, no problem. But did they win the fight?
But in that case, they're all quite upset and they're in a bad mood. And he's like, "Hey guys, what's going on?" And they're like, "Oh, we just lost a game to," and they drop an N-bomb.
Yep,
spicy.
Yeah, so he's not in a good situation.
Yeah, so he gets pummeled in prison, and he has to, once he gets out, he has to run to class, which he's late for, and he doesn't have his paper, and the professor is like, I told you all, no exceptions, you need to have your paper in on time, and
no excuses,
even though he clearly was beaten by a bunch of angry whites.
Yeah, he says, I just spent 18 hours in a jail cell getting beaten up by bigots, and I couldn't finish my paper. And I'm like, wait, you weren't starting your paper until the night before it was due?
I mean, that's pretty college, if you really
think. There are two kinds of students.
Yeah.
James
Earl Jones told you how important this paper was. You don't start until the night before it's due. That's kind of on you, dude.
Yeah. Which, in fairness, is in keeping with his character being a slackass at this point. This is credit to James Earl Jones to make it clear. Like, I got that the suggestion of this scene was like. His professor was not surprised that he got beat up in prison because that could be, that life is hard for us, and you should be prepared. It's not going to get less hard for you being a black person as an attorney. You have to work harder than everyone else.
Like, Mark does try to play the race card though. He was like, I thought you would understand.
Yes.
Come on, baby. And, come on, brother.
Yeah.
You know what it is. Yeah, try to do all that.
and James Earl Jones is like, all right, you can turn in your paper at 9 tomorrow morning, which honestly seems more than reasonable considering the circumstances. He didn't even have to do that much. So Mark stays up all night to finish his paper.
He stays up all night and he gets serious about school now. See, those angry bigots just beat him serious about his school. They made him, it's like American History X. It made him a better person.
That is the lesson of the film, is that maybe you just didn't meet the right person. Oh, <God. laughs>
Yeah!
So in the montage of him becoming a better student and getting closer with, is it Sarah?
Yeah.
There is a moment that is the second time my wife spoke up in this entire ordeal I made her watch this film. And the second time is when they're together. And at this point, he realizes that Sarah, I think we may have skipped this scene, but he realizes Sarah is a mom. She has a little kid who's precocious and adorable. He's getting closer with her and her family. There's a scene where they're in her apartment studying, and it's snowing outside.
Oh,
yes.
And Sarah says, it's snowing. And they go out to have another little cute scene with in the newly fallen snow. Yeah. So it is clearly played for romance.
Yes.
She says, it's snowing. And they go out, and it's a touching moment, sort of. And my wife says, it's Boston.
Yeah.
It's always snowing.
It's snowing. And why is she excited? I mean, it was snowing.
Well, they cover that because he says, like, it's like you've never seen the snow before. And she's like, I'm from San Diego. I have never seen the snow before.
Oh, my God. I was laughing so hard at what my wife said. I didn't hear exposition in the film. I need to give this another watch. Can we record this podcast?
I mean, obviously, there are layers you missed.
Yeah, I can't. I don't feel prepared to review this film or to judge it now. I'm going to
pause the recording and you can just rewatch it again real fast.
Give me a quick hour and a half and I'll be back.
All right, we'll wait.
She says like she's from San Diego and that's how they kind of transition in there. Because he's like, oh, I'm from Los Angeles. And she's like, oh, you're the one who beat me out for the scholarship. And he's what do you mean? Yeah. And she says, oh, well, the scholarship that you got was going to open up to the entire state if there were no other applicants in LA. And I checked like 2 days before the due date and there was no one there. And then you swooped in and you got it. And I'm like, and I'm hearing this. And I'm like, do scholarships work like that? Do they only open it up to one city? And then like 2 days before
I think
they open it up to an entire state.
I think the physics of this, the world this is set in, that is how scholarships work, and that's how tan pills work.
Right.
So, yes, that would be, it's a little odd, a little contrived, but it brings out the feelings, the emotions. Yeah,
he starts to get a conscience from this, and he's like, okay, all right, I can't do this anymore. I've deprived this deserving person of the scholarship. I'm going to go turn myself in.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah does make a comment that he is turning white when she tells him the news.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which I was like, ah! Yes.
Irony!
Yeah.
So he's going to turn himself in. We have another awkward scene with Julie Louis-Dreyfus and her brother, and her boyfriend.
Whoa, easy! Whoa! Not that type of movie.
Might as well have been. Yeah. Honestly, might as well have been. There was no reason.
Anyway, and you know, so he again, he's doing the Stevie Wonder head bob. I guess I should say the Eddie Murphy Stevie Wonder head bob thing.
Yes.
And Julia's like, I saw Eddie Murphy do that for like 3 years. I'm not
My sketches got bumped because of that.
That's nothing new for me. And we see Mark's name on a plaque for the scholarship that he won. And so he goes in to see James Earl Jones, and James Earl Jones is like, I should let you know I'm on the Judiciary Committee.
We have James Earl Jones on the podcast. Wow, amazing. James, I thought you had passed. I'm so glad you're here. We could talk to you. What's it like being in a voiceover box in the vault, in the Disney vault?
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Nice.
Thank you. Dose of James Earl Jones.
There's no James Earl Jones voice for pretty cool. Like, no. Yeah.
James Earl Ghost.
But he's like, I should let you know I'm on this Judiciary Committee. I'm never doing the voice again now.
Yeah.
Then I'm on this, you know, and like these people were caught in wrongdoing and it like, you know, some were expelled, some their lives were ruined. They couldn't ever get any work. And he's just painting this horrible picture. And you think that he's on to Mark and he's about to expose Mark. And Mark's like, oh, you know, I know what you're leading up to, sir. And then we got a turn and he's like, well, you know, because I'm very impressed with how you've turned your grades around this semester and I'm going to recommend you for the committee.
I love that even with blackface, his innate whiteness and his ability to fail upwards carried on. He was still able to fail upwards. That's
white
amazing.
Privilege,
it's
baby.
It's in the DNA. I mean, I can't explain it any other way.
Yep. Yeah,
must be nice. Must be real nice.
Oh, it's awesome.
Damn it.
So he's like, yeah, I'd like you to be on this committee because we'd like to keep the same ethnic makeup to the committee.
Yeah, representation. Yeah. Black representation on the committee.
So
you know, he starts to freak out now. It's like, oh, he didn't come forward with who he really is. He tells Gordon, it's like, yeah, I'm really nervous. I think I can go to jail for this. And Gordon's like, oh, yeah, of course. You totally can go to jail for this.
Yeah, it's fraud. It's criminal.
He's like, why don't you try to stop me then? So then, you know, he gets nervous because he said he knows Sarah is coming over to study. Gordon tells him to go look in his bedroom, and who's waiting in his bedroom but Whitney, you know, ready for romance. So
he wants sexy time.
Yeah. So he's like, oh my God, she has to get out of here. And oh my God, hijinks ensue. Mark's parents are here as well.
Hijinks.
Yeah.
So you would hope that the hijinks either heightens the tension or elevates the thing you're trying to say, or
does it though?
Makes
does
it like something funny? Funnier? It's none of it. It's
this
just
whole
like,
this whole sequence. It didn't have the pace that it should.
Yeah,
you know, because like we're doing a farce here.
Yeah,
you know, and so he should be zipping back and forth among all these rooms, you know, dealing with Whitney, dealing with his parents in the kitchen, dealing with like Sarah shows up a little while later for their study date, and he's like telling different excuses to all of them. But it's, yeah, it just doesn't move at the pace that it should. And so it's not funny. All the air just goes out of it. You know?
It's trying to be like an episode of like Three's Company or something. And it's just not getting there.
Yeah.
Should be like noises off.
Or like, you know, scenes in Tootsie where he's like trying to deal with multiple people who know him as his various identities coming over to the apartment. And it just doesn't work. He puts on a ski mask and gloves to disguise the blackface from his parents.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, I have a cold, and I'm really gross, so I put a ski mask on my face.
Right.
That, yeah, you know, like as like you do when you have a cold.
Yeah.
And, without the ski mask, he's unidentifiable to his parents.
Yes. Like, yes, he at one point comes in as a black man, and they do not recognize him in the least.
Yes.
So.
And, of course, the parents are freaking out. It's like, oh, get behind me, Karens. Brother,
I did enjoy that the father imagined a knife on him.
Yeah.
I liked, like, he leaves Whitney alone in his bedroom. She starts going through his record collection at one point. She puts on a Beach Boys album, and at one point, like, you know, Mark starts, they're playing California Girls, and he's like, wow, these guys suck.
I don't listen to this jive turkey nonsense. Come on, man.
Mark, at one point, he throws Whitney out the window onto the fire escape. And, you know, hijinks ensue. Everybody's exposed.
Yeah, because the landlord sees that Whitney's out on the fire escape, and that's enough for him to call Mr. Dunbar and get them kicked out. Sarah comes in. She sees Whitney coming back in the apartment, so she's freaked out. So then she's about to leave, and then Mark's parents meet with Sarah, and like everybody doesn't know what's going on. So then that's when Mark comes clean and says, "Yeah, I'm white, but I'm black." Like even the big reveal didn't feel like as climactic as it should have been.
I mean, yeah, this should be where like all the main characters find out the truth, but it's not really that.
Yeah. The parents don't really get any, I mean, I don't know if you call them main characters. They don't really get anything. They're literally just there for the laugh.
They're pretty oblivious.
Whitney never really mattered. And I don't think she ever really learns anything. Well, we know she doesn't as we find out more about her. And Sarah just finds out something horrible is happening, but I don't think has it spelled out for her.
I think she just thinks that he's cheating on her at this point.
I'm pretty sure it's I'm with Whitney, and then maybe I have white parents.
Yeah,
I guess it's very odd.
She leaves upset.
But we get to see Leslie Nielsen punch him in the gut.
Yeah,
and then right after Jeff Altman gives him a notice of eviction.
That wasn't even in the script. Leslie Nielsen was
read that page of the script, and he was like, I'm in what movie?
Wait a minute, you guys are really shooting?
Boom. And then he just punched the lead actor and stormed off the set. He's like, fuck this, I'm calling the Zucker Brothers.
That's right. I got to make people believe this was all a joke or else I'm screwed. And this is actually, he says something like he can't imagine what she's been through around this time. And we're going to get a couple nods to this where he starts talking in the language of privilege without having the words to express it. We'll go more into the film until it wraps up because it really hits hard at the end. But like, he definitely feels bad about this.
Right.
To some degree.
Yeah.
And it's maybe like only 80%.
To the extent that a white person can feel bad about stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like 80% that the girl he likes, he hurt.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. And a little bit more of the, oh, this is also probably like
problematic.
A bad look.
Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't have done the blackface.
Maybe
fraud.
Maybe this wasn't as cool and rad as I thought it was.
But mostly because it hurt this girl that I'm into.
Yeah. Yes.
I didn't expect to fall in love.
So we get the final exam. Mark is realizing that he's in love with Sarah. They take the final exam. I don't think they get their grades yet. Yeah, they don't find that out for a bit. And then we're leaving for the Christmas break, and Gordon's flying back home to L.A. And Mark is like, I'm just going to stay here and figure out, you know, what I'm doing next. And he's like, you better go and get your flight. And then Gordon leaves. But then he immediately comes back, and he's like, I'm going to help you figure this out.
Oh,
yeah.
Bros.
Yeah, because Gordon, as we establish later on, is Jewish, I believe. And his white privilege doesn't outweigh our main characters, whose gravitational pull of failing upwards means he will get more support from the community.
Right.
There's a whole. The physics of racism is complicated, but we'll map it up and we'll leave it in the podcast notes.
Yeah. Absolutely. So then we got to this whole judiciary committee. They give the date of January 13th, so it's like start of the new semester. And we see like the whole student body coming for Mark's big hearing. And we see Whitney walk in, and she's got a new boyfriend who's like a Native American guy. And she's spouting nonsense to him.
She gives a line where she doesn't think it's one or the other, it's shades of pink, which is a reference to her shades of gray.
Right.
She was after a black man because it's not black and white, shades of gray. So this, we have to presume, is shades of pink is red and white.
Yes.
And the Native American guy looks at her the way you would look at a person who was saying those things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not good. And she is also staring at a black guy in that scene when she walks in.
Oh, my.
Oh, is she? I don't think I noticed that.
She's kind of like giving him...
Okay, no time to unpack that.
Yeah, no.
Taste the rainbow.
So Gordon comes in to defend Mark at the hearing, and you know he's doing like his sort of lawyer BS. I don't think we ever get into like what kind of law Mark is or Gordon is studying.
We've never seen him in a class. I think
we haven't. No,
he's only there to lend moral support to the main character.
Right.
In fact, there may be a version of this film where he's like Tyler Durden. He just exists in his mind.
Maybe he's in class with like the two racist joke tellers.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, they're in
racism 101.
Racism 101. part of his defense is making this big, first of all, a lot of it is just lame stuff that if you were James Earl Jones's character, you're just like, why am I letting you talk?
Yeah,
but beyond
he's
that,
just BSing his way through it.
He's talking about the moral fiber of the people he grew up with, the community of this person. And everything, if you look at the expression on James Earl Jones's face and on several of the black students that they kind of cut to, they are thinking that an excuse is being made for C. Thomas Howell because he's black and raised by black people, and black people are inherently illegal, like, you know, prone to criminality or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the look on their face the entire time. That's the intent the film is, I think, supposed to be showing, that he's trying to make it seem like it's the culture of the he grew up in that made him do these horrible things. And he's right. Right?
Yeah.
Because Gordon is right. It's because C. Thomas Howell's character was raised this privileged white person, that's why he thought he could get away with all this.
Right.
Ooh.
So it's interesting, and it's something the film almost does right.
There's a YouTube channel that I follow called This Aged Great, where they just go through lots of movies that are problematic. And the joke is, like, they're, you know, hey, there's no problem with this at all. And I they did a video on Soul Man, and I rewatched it last night. Very funny. And they say, you know, yeah, that's the real tragedy of racism. It's not really bad until it happens to rich white people.
Oh, yeah. God. Not wrong.
Yeah.
Not wrong.
So let's see, where are we? So Mark walks in and he is re-whitified. He's back to his regular Caucasian skin tone.
So what pills do you think he took?
I don't know. See, we don't get into how this happened at all. Did he have to like stop taking the pills at a certain time? Did they just wear off right in time? Has he been taking the pills for the entire semester?
Do you think he has to take it hourly to keep it up and he just has to stop? He's like, I spent 3 hours. I purged. My kidneys are a mess, by the way.
I just wish we got into the timing of this, because like if it was just makeup, yeah, okay, you can undo that at a moment's notice or with relatively short notice. But this is like it's a medical situation. So how did he time that out? I'm just very curious there.
To write letters.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I'm gonna write Carol Black and just say, explain this to me, please.
Explain it to me like I'm five.
Yeah.
He comes out, you know, he's back to his roots, his white roots, and everybody's aghast and in shock, and then we cut to him.
Half the people in the hearing go, no wonder.
Oh. Yeah,
like Whitney goes, no wonder. And
That's why he had the small dick.
And other people are like, oh, no wonder he did, this. Yeah.
Right. So, Sarah sees it. Of course, she's horrified and upset and storms out. And then we see Mark talks to James Earl Jones in private in his office, and he wants to give Sarah the grant money plus interest, and he wants to volunteer time to do like legal aid work in the black community. He also wants a contract drawn so a percentage of his income after college goes to a scholarship to be started in Sarah's name, and he wants to put his law degree to good use. It really does seem like he's really, like...
These were pretty good offers.
Yeah, right?
After each sort of, I guess, concession or whatever you want to call it that Mark gives, James Earl Jones is going like, and then he Mark finally winds it up with, I'd like to get a law degree, sir, and I'd like to get a law degree.
Right.
And, you know, good finish.
Yeah. It seems like he really is like finally realizing the seriousness of his actions and what he did here and how truly fucked up it was.
And like one of the bits of dialogue that I did really like is James Earl Jones says something like, well, it sounds like you've learned a valuable lesson about what it's like to be black in America. And Mark just replies, no, I didn't, because if I ever didn't like it, I could always stop.
That's right.
Yes, this is where I'm going with it, this film.
Yeah.
It's trying really hard, and there are so many missteps where, like, it's almost as if some racist person in the production company was like, I can't greenlight this film, we have a little bit more... people calling each other honkies and watermelons. But like the point was that, you know, he could not abandon his white privilege to just live the life of a black person and learn what it's like to be them just by putting on some makeup or tanning pills, whatever.
Yeah.
And like, that's interesting. That's where
one of the kids is like, he doesn't get it until he realizes like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, where he's going back and forth with Token over like what it means, what goes through his head when he hears the N-word.
Right.
So, and he's like, I don't get it. And then Token's like, yes, now you finally get it because you don't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, impressive for a film, I guess, in 1986 to at least attempt to explain that in some way. I can't say that it succeeded. I think Roger Ebert pretty much got it. And, you know, Spike Lee was pretty close. I think it was maybe unfair to Ray Don Chong. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's maybe unfair of him to criticize it that publicly with only seeing clips of the movie, but
true.
Yeah, that I would say that too. Like, you can't give your whole opinion on a film just seeing, like, you know, like TikTok clips here and there. But on the other hand,
if he'd like watched clips of the dinner scene, I totally get it.
Yeah.
So it's hard to outweigh the things it does wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, and I'm not a famed genius filmmaker like Spike Lee, but I think I know a little bit about blackface. And I wait, no.
What?
Yeah.
Cut that soundbite, ladies and gentlemen.
Yay. But yeah, it's definitely attempting to say something that it is very awkwardly not quite landing on, because it keeps putting its own foot in its mouth.
Yeah,
including even the ending, which was interesting if it was a romantic comedy where, like, he, you know, he learns his lesson. I guess we could get to that, but
So at the very end, Sarah and you know, her son George are in the cafeteria. Sarah sees that Mark is working there now. Mark, you know, just goes.
Wait,
over
what?
He's got one of those jobs.
Yeah.
Oh, the job.
He got a job. He walks over to Sarah, says hi. Says, I just want to make sure you got the check and the money. Like, I got it there with interest. We learned that he sold his car to get the interest, and like he's really like seriously trying to make amends. But you know, she's still kind of rebuffs.
And he's staying in school because his father gave him a loan to cover his expenses to Harvard with 25% interest.
Yes. Oh, and James.
That's part of why the parents were visiting him, because they had a change of heart.
Yes.
They were coming back from Barbados and they were like, hey, we're gonna cover your school fees after all.
Right. And James Earl Jones agreed not to press any charges, so he can stay and he's not going to prison to get beat up by green cap bigots anymore. Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, Sarah finds out she got an A for the final test. Mark got an A minus.
Right.
And, you know, and you can tell that he's really trying to be honest and sincere about everything. And she's still not quite, you know, she's still not quite there. She doesn't really want to, like, forgive him but you can tell she kind of does. And she's kind of, then she leaves. And as she leaves the cafeteria, who should show up? the Statler and Waldorf of this film.
Oh, man. Remember the early Statler Muppet show where they Klansman. Just drop it up, racist comment after racist comment?
Yeah, that's so good.
They had this. That's the reason why they did animals in the Muppet Show. Did you know that? They're like, we can't have him referencing Fozzie's race. Why don't we just make him a bear? All right, yeah, that works.
That's bearest.
Oh!
And yeah, so they're in the cafeteria. They tell yet another racist joke. They see Mark, and Mark punches them out. You know, and then he goes, "No offense."
Yeah, those two go flying into some tables like stuntman shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the racists was Wallace Langham.
Was it really?
Yeah. So he, like, CSI.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I wonder what kind of grade those guys got on their racism final.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think they put the work in.
You know, like for their final, they had to, like, put a burning cross somewhere.
They definitely got the key to the city. We'll say that.
Yeah, they did. They got the key to Boston.
Yeah, they're cops now or something.
They probably are. They were interning over that cop. We saw earlier.
Wow. Yeah.
Ooh.
Most improved racist.
Yeah.
Gotta say, your jokes have gotten way more racist over the course of the semester.
Yeah.
I'm proud.
Keep it up, bro. You'll make valedictorian with that attitude.
As cool as that scene was, you know, taking out those races, finally, it is still undercut by the fact that he was so okay with them for so long. And
well, he was just sort of swallowing his pride or whatever.
But like literally at the beginning, he's like, "Oh, I hope I didn't, you know, bother those races by looking shocked at them."
Sure.
Don't want to rock the boat. This is to Spike Lee's point, which I'm sure this is one of the clips he saw. After he does this, he leaves, and the one of the few other, I think, unnamed black characters in the film kind of just does like a fist, glad he did that.
Yeah,
and
right on.
I'm like, they so
was
the
that
blacks,
was that possibly the same guy that we saw in the basketball game?
Yes,
who he was going up against? Yeah, who was like a very tall.
Yeah,
gentleman.
It was him, and I think he was the one that Whitney stares at when she's with her new boyfriend. But it begs the question: why do none of the black characters in this film have agency? Why aren't they doing anything? And that's kind of where I think that's where this whole thing falls apart. When you look at it, you're like, I get what you're trying to say, but like, maybe you weren't the people to make this movie. Maybe other people could have had some input on
like,
this.
Like
as
their
well.
Reach kind of exceeded their grasp.
Yeah, there's that. And the fact that there wasn't, again, a named, like Sarah didn't get, she heard them be racist before. I guess she had a kid with her that could have justified why she didn't knock them out. Plus, they were varsity racists. So, the team would never make it to nationals if they lost their.
But anyway, like after he knocks out the racists, like he goes outside and, you know, and Sarah agrees to date him. Because like earlier, he's like, how do you feel about interracial relationships? And he's asking that as a black. He's still appearing as a black man at the time. And so I guess Sarah thinks that he's talking about his relationship with Whitney.
Yeah.
But, you know, he comes out and he's like, you never answered my question. How do you feel about interracial relationships? And she says something like, well, honestly, I've never met a white man that I was interested in romantically. But, you know, if you feel strongly about each other, I guess it's cool. Oh. So they basically decide to date.
That's right. The movie solved racism, guys. It did it.
And and her son is totally cool with it. Like all he says is, you look funny as a white man. Like, really? Really? Yeah. Does he?
Well, that was the only take they were allowed to use. That kid said a lot of things.
A lot of off-color things.
That was the only take they had that didn't use the word cracker.
Yes.
Yeah.
As everyone knows, the worst thing you could ever call a white person, or any person, really.
Right.
It's
the worst one.
Yep.
And that's the end of the movie. Yeah, like I said before, it's not as cringy or whatever as I thought it'd be, but it's definitely not great. I think I agree with Roger Ebert's assessment of it, where there are interesting ideas here, but the execution falls apart. That's it. I'll say that.
Yeah, I don't think as a comedy it's as funny as it could be, because it has a lot of missed opportunities. I don't know if I want to say it could have gone farther, but it seemed to. I don't know. It didn't go as far as it could have, and maybe we should be grateful for that. But
yeah. It feels as if they didn't make it. I mean, obviously, just not having input from black people
in
the film may have been a problem. And then also the problem was where they put they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. Right. Mm-hmm. Those early scenes are the dinner party where you see three racists' vision of what a black person's like.
Yeah.
We're definitely like, look how racist these white people were, but it was also, look how funny these stereotypes are.
Yeah, true.
Right?
True.
So, like, they were trying to, they wanted.
They were trying to have it both ways.
Yeah. So, I think final word on this film should be given to the blackest person on the podcast, which we are going to determine by vote. So, if you are an SNL Nerds fan, leave a comment with the name of the blackest person.
You son of a bitch.
This is awful. Oh, God.
Well,
our social media is
Let me get prepared for my statement.
All right.
but there's interesting, like on the Wikipedia page, there's a whole section of the wiki about the controversy and then the legacy And it's got statements, quotes from both Ray Dong Chong and C. Thomas Howell in it. And interestingly enough, the two of them got together after this movie and were actually married for a year.
Oh, really?
After this movie. The late 80s, yeah.
Look at that. This is
holy. Yeah. Wow. Look at that.
Ray Dong Chong, she later defended the film. She says it was only controversial because Spike Lee made a thing of it. He'd never seen the movie and he just jumped all over it. He was just starting and pulling everyone down in his wake. If you watch the movie, it's really making white people look stupid.
The
film
is
adorable and it didn't deserve it. I always tried to be an actor who was doing a part that was a character versus what I call blacting or playing my race. Oh, blacting, like black acting. Got it. Or playing my race because I knew that I would fail because I was mixed. And then it says in parentheses, Chong is of African, Chinese, and European ancestry. Her dad is Chommy Chong, if you didn't know.
Yeah.
I was the black actor for sure, but I didn't lead with my epidermis, and that offended people like Spike Lee, I think. You're either militant or you're not, and he decided to just attack. I've never forgiven him for that because it really hurt me. I didn't realize at the time that not pushing the Afrocentric agenda was going to bite me. When you start doing well, people start to say you're a Tom, as in Uncle Tom, because you're acceptable.
And I don't like that. I'm not sure about
Thomas
that.
Howell. This is
especially the whole you have to be militant and people acting with their epidermis. I think she is. It seems like she's swinging too far the other way, where you're now criticizing an entire method of acting or actor. I don't know.
Yeah,
this whole thing seems like it's a lot more. Yeah. People took it more personally than was maybe intended. I don't know. The movie was, I don't know if this podcast is going to make it come back. I don't think there's going to be a reboot.
No?
But if so, who would you cast?
Oh, boy.
I would cast Awkwafina as every
as every character.
Every character in the film.
I would cast Robert Downey Jr. as every character in the film.
Because
he's pulled it off once.
Yeah, he could probably do it again.
Yeah.
Billy Crystal. I mean.
Scarlett Johansson.
Jimmy Fallon's done blackface.
Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson, yeah.
Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson.
Let's see. Yeah, that would be good too. I think, you know what? Eddie Murphy could probably pull it off. Eddie Murphy, if you give him enough prosthetics,
I mean, if somebody
he
like
could
Eddie
probably
Murphy
be.
Was in this movie, it would be more outrageous and it would go further and it would probably be more successful as a comedy, I think.
Yeah. And what the difference would be? I believe Eddie Murphy is, what's this? Let me look up his race. Hold on.
Okay. And,
do you have it in your binder?
yes.
Give you a minute.
Look at that. Black.
Huh?
I did not see that coming.
All right. I guess that'll work out.
All right.
Mm.
Okay. And those are our final thoughts on the movie. And that's the episode, guys. Thanks again for listening to the podcast. And as always, you can follow us on the Blue Skies at SNL Nerds. Follow us on the YouTubes at SNL Nerds. And Frank, our good friend Frank here, where can people find you, my friend?
Streets of Boston, protecting my turf from
Jesus Christ,
from
beating up people in jail when your team loses.
Other in bad sports fans. I don't know.
Holy Toledo! Wow, this fell apart.
Yeah, no, not yeah. This is not a good look. Don't judge me based on the contents of this podcast, as always, because I watch good movies occasionally, like just legitimately good movies. In fact,
people should judge you on the color of your character, right?
Yes. Yeah. Just my color. That's it. It's fine. That works.
Nice. Okay. And you can follow me on all social medias at Darren Credible, D-A-R-I Incredible. John?
You can follow me on all the socials at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L and the word comic. And
Oh boy.
So.
Okay. So I don't know if we want to talk about what we're doing next week, or I think we're still talking about it. We're still trying to.
I think we're not quite ready to commit. Is what I got from our conversation.
Earlier. Not ready for prime time. Yeah. Okay.
That's a great name for a thing.
That's catchy.
Yeah, it'll work.
It's pretty catchy. Yeah.
How do you normally end these podcasts? Do you say something? You say goodbye? Or
something like that, yeah.
Howdy?
You really you should say, start listening to this. I think you might enjoy it.
You guys say, what's up? No, that's...
Hey now!
No, please keep guessing.
Hoo-hoo-hoo!
We all say, what you talking about, Willis?
What you talking about, Willis? If you guys had under 2 hours for how long it would take for John Drubble to make a Different Strokes reference,
right?
You made it. You hit the over under.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll be back next week with something cool. We promise. But until then, nerds out.
Howdy who? Nerds out.
You're the fucking producer.
Yeah, I know what it is.
And you're sabotaging it.
I'm gonna add this to the end of the podcast.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.